adjusted, Beth. KE2EJ, WA2CDL, can either of you guys find out why we get as much noise as we do? Well, we're proceeding, and I think they'll correct a little bit.
I'm in, Dick.
Roger, Dodger. Okay, looks like things are back to normal. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll hear three other guys on this net tonight. John, KC2WGB, Paul, WS2N, and Hal, K6TPZ. The TechNet began 30 and a half years ago, 1982. This is TechNet number 1,458. And the net is slowly evolving. We've added new things to the menu as time goes on in order to keep everybody happy, even though it's possible. You know what I mean? The TechNet is a gathering of ham radio operators discussing their favorite subject and helping each other, educating each other. We try to tap into that, what we believe is a fantastic amount of brain power in the New York City area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Long Island. However, we're going far and wide now. The guys who run this machine have added Echolink and IRLP, so quite often we hear the brain power from Connecticut, from Canada and all kinds of places. The TechNet is extemporaneous, in other words, live, as you hear it. By that I mean there are times when the TechNet will have very interesting subjects to you, and times when it will not. We don't have any canned programs per se, it's not prepared ahead of time. The subjects being discussed are 95% what you guys bring as subjects to be discussed or as questions. The usual menu is as follows on the job. And the new menu, as I should be saying, is as follows. For the first hour or so, we take sign-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. If you're just listening, we have reason to believe there's a large number of listeners. You don't need a sign-in to tell us that you're listening. After 30 years, we believe somebody is listening. So we take sign-ins from people who do have a question or a comment, and we try to treat those questions somewhat lightly. And lately, Hal, K60PZ, is added to the mix because he's teaching me, so to speak, how to answer questions a little bit more briefly. I don't know why, but occasionally somebody's accused me of being verbose and long-winded, but we'll see about that. After that first hour, John, KC2WGB, goes to the mailbag, where people who don't yet have their ham license or don't yet have the equipment by which they can sign in and talk to us live, they give John those questions. And if they're of a general nature, John brings two or three of those out, and we discuss those. The next thing on the menu is that Paul, WS2N, our space expert, tells us what NASA has been doing. And NASA's always doing some interesting things. Unfortunately, Hal can only stick with us between 9 and 10, but during that time, he's going to be teaching me how to be a little bit more brief and to the point on how to give these answers. So what you hear is live discussions. We are not making promises that people will get free consulting service during the week in a written form. There's lots of people requesting that, and that's a little bit above and beyond the call of duty. Let me drop for another time. In the beginning of 1982, the TechNet began in a peculiar way, which I won't go into right now, where it was approximately 1 hour. And people started complaining that it wasn't long enough. It got to 2 hours and 3 hours. And right now, it's 4 hours every single Sunday night. We start at 8 o'clock and end at midnight, even though the notice for the TechNet always says we start at 8 o'clock and end at 8 o'clock. And for some reason, for the last 6 months, that can't get corrected, but it still says that. During those 4 hours, we try to cover all these subjects and try to keep everybody happy. The machine automatically gets turned off at midnight at my request. The reason for that is some of these enthusiastic people will go until the next dawn, and a few times they've almost tried doing that. And some of us have got to go to work the next morning. And when it comes to whether or not you can stick into the whole TechNet, there's a very nice website you might want to go to by Mike Perry, KC2NJI. That TechNet, that Mike, the website I'm talking about, where Mike has recorded the last 6.5 years of the technical net. So there's a lot of material there you can go back and review. You choose the right year, the right month, the right week, the right hour, load on that particular reel to your recording device, whatever it is, and some people do that. And while they're driving to work or sitting on the train or at noontime, they listen to the TechNet, even stay up that late that night, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. The only slight disadvantage is that Mike lives over there in Hawthorne, New Jersey, and occasionally the propagation from this machine over to Hawthorne is a little bit less than desirable, so occasionally the recordings are a little bit noisy. Mike is making improvements to his antenna system, so that's getting better. Okay, at this time we're going to take check-ins of people who do have a question or a comment. The usual way people sign in is to give me their name, their call letters, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in might sound like this, WA2PJF, Vito and yes. So give me your check-in call letters and name right now, K2RAW.
K2RAW, yes.
Okay, that was a quadruple. Let me go down the list first. Vito, did I hear your name in there?
Dick, not at all, but I'm listening as usual, Dick. Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Okay, so it wasn't Vito. Okay. We're going to get all you guys. Don't worry. One at a time. Give me your call and name right now.
W-A-2-R-A-S, Jeff, yes.
Okay, we got Jeff, W-A-2-R-A-F. Who's the next one?
KC2-MDP, Steve, and yes.
Steve, glad to hear from you. One of our frequent sign-ins, okay? We got Jeff and Steve. Anyone else?
KC2-MDP, Whiskey, yes.
What's the real question, Dick? Okay, we got Wes, and we got some guy named Paul. Okay, WS2N, got you on the list, Paul. Alrighty, so right now, Jeff, Steve, Wes, and Paul. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KD2CMQ, Neil, yes.
Okay, we got you, Neil. Anybody else?
KC2WGB, yes, if we have time.
No, I don't think we're going to have time. Very fine, Jeff. We got more than enough to get started. Okay. The very first guy is Jeff, Whiskey Alpha 2, Royal Air Force. Go right ahead, Jeff, K2RAW.
Dick, K2RAW, this is WA2RA Sierra, radio amateur station, actually, or Royal Air Squadron. Anyway, thanks for picking me up, Dick. I have something that I never saw happen before. Maybe it did happen before, but I never saw it. I have a Gonset Communicator 3 from back in the day, 60-year-old 2-meter transceiver, and it works fine. But what happens is, I usually run it through a brick amp, which is keyed by RF. And when you turn the communicator off, that's turning the AC power off. It is not in transmit, it's in receive. Turning the, you're done. You're going QRT. You turn the power off, it keys the relay. In the amplifier. The amplifier is keyed by RF, and you start hearing the relay in the amplifier chattering. How is that, what is happening, and how is that possible? K2RIW, WA2RAS.
Comments.
Stand by there, Vito. When we get a chance, the guy on Long Island who owns more equipment of that age than anybody else is Hal, K6DPZ. I'm going to be going over to him in a minute. But first, Vito wants to give us a comment. I wonder if you've owned one of those, Vito. WA2PJF, K2RIW.
For what it's worth, I've heard that situation many times. Many people, you must have a Mirage amplifier, I'm guessing. And if it's a Mirage, that situation is a normal thing. No, I shouldn't say normal. It's customary. It happens. It's been known. That's an ailment with the Mirage amplifiers, if that's what you have. A lot of people have complained about that. That's why I never bought one of those. Back to you, Dick, and we'll see what Hal has to say about this.
Very fine, Vito. I've got a couple of guesses as to what's going on, but I've never owned a... Set up at the Gonset 3. Guarantee Hal has had about five of those in his hand.
PC. Okay, the first thing I mentioned to Jeff is the Communicator 3 is a very strange animal. What they're doing in their PTT circuit, when you turn the Communicator 3 on, it pulls in all the king relays in the transceiver and has it in receive. So all the king relays are activated in the receive mode. And what may be happening is when you shut the communicator off, it momentarily drops into transmit. And if it drops into transmit, you'll get an RF pulse that will key the amplifier. That's my comment. Dick, why don't you throw something into the mix?
Yeah, a man using ordinary common sense. That's good information, Hal. Using ordinary common sense, as Jeff is doing, Royal Air Service, when you turn off a piece of equipment, you assume that the on-off switch really kills all power. The thing that struck my attention real fast is that when Jeff told us that the Mirage amplifier sits there and chatters its relay, I mean, if it was just one pulse coming out of the transmitter, the relay would key once and then go back to normal. The way the Mirage works, and you can't blame this on Mirage, the Mirage RF keyed circuit, when it sees RF as if you're about to transmit and there's a detector circuit in the front end, those diodes rectify the RF, that rectified voltage goes into an amplifier transistor which pulls in the relay, and the thing is set up for the transmit mode. When you go back to the receive mode, the Mirage assumes that all RF is going to cease forever, therefore that relay circuit and that RF detecting circuit drops out, and it should go back to the receive mode forever. But the fact that it's sitting there and chattering suggests to me that something else is going on. So let me, I may have gone a little bit too far on this one, Jeff. When you hear the Mirage relay chattering, does it just last for a couple of seconds, or is it continuous? How long did that go on there, Jeff? To B2RAS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, by the way, thank you, everybody, for the wise counsel. K2RAW in the net, WA2RAS. First of all, it's not a Mirage. I said it's a brick amp. It's actually a Tokyo high power amplifier. Actually, I do have a Mirage, but that's not, it's not for 2 meters. I have a 6 meter Mirage. And to answer your question, Dick, I would say it lasts for about, 2 seconds, maybe. I would say about 2 seconds. And that's it. K2RIW, WA2RAS.
Is it a chatter or a click?
Almost doesn't matter. The fact that it's 2 seconds, and whatever it does for those 2 seconds, I am guessing that as he turns off the rig, Hal guessed that the relays are dropping back from the receive mode to the transmit mode. The filter capacitors within the Gonset haven't yet thoroughly discharged, even though the power's been turned off. And so a burst of the transmitter takes place. Pulling in that relay on the Tokyo high power is my guess. Hal, it's K6DPZ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Hal.
2RIW, K6DPZ. Well, one way to find out for sure, Jeff, if the transmitter is keying it on when it drops off, is just pull out the crystal if it's on the transmitter and see then what happens when you key it. If it still transmits, it keys the amplifier. How's that sound to you, Dick?
I think 90% of the time what you said to Hal is going to work. By that I mean the Gonset, you and I are assuming that without the crystal plugged in, it doesn't have the ability to transmit. The crystal is trying to determine exactly what frequency you're on. Occasionally, a guy designs an oscillator in such a way that there's enough feedback in the oscillator that without a crystal, it'll still oscillate on some crazy frequency, and with the crystal, it gets pulled into your favorite frequency. I doubt it, but it's something to consider. So I'm going to give you a guess on my part, Jeff, that there's a 90% chance you unplug the crystal, then turn off the Gonset, and you're not going to see the chatter or the movement at all of the relay on your Tokyo high power. By the way, that movement on the Tokyo high power relay, assuming it's only for 2 seconds, nothing bad is happening. It's not hurting anything. It's just an annoyance. And you being a bit of a scientist are asking the question, how come, why, and does it indicate anything I should be alarmed about? The V2RAS, when you get a chance to run that experiment, and you're allowed to come back during the net and tell us what you find out, when you run that experiment, come back and tell us, Jeff, the V2RAS, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, I will do that. Well, thank you very much. By the way, I think it was Hal that asked whether it was a click or a chatter. It's a chatter. It's not just the relay engaging. It chatters. But as you say, very sort of like false teeth. Those little chattering false teeth that you wind up. Very briefly. It's like a burst. And that's it. Okay. Well, thank you for the wise counsel. I'm glad I checked in. Back to you, Dick. K2RAW, WA2RAS.
Mr. ZX, you over the comment? Mr. ZX, I should know you very well. Tell me your name and your comment. Go right ahead. Miss Jerry, very simple. Why don't you turn the fire off first, then turn off the concert, rather than pulling out the crystal, which, makes you complete the spike, keep on pulling it out. So turn the amplifier off, then turn off the radio. That should solve the problem. But turn the power to the amplifier off. That should solve the problem. K2RIW, WB2ZX Mobile. Another good suggestion, Jerry. However, that'll stop the relay from moving, and you're absolutely right. But nothing bad is happening, and if he turns off the power to his Tokyo High Power, or turns it off, he might forget to not turn it on the next time this great DX is coming in on that the concert is receiving, and he won't have the amplifier there. So nothing bad is happening during that chatter, in my opinion. And when it comes to the chatter, which really means an on-off function of the transmitter, another guess as to what goes on is that the burst of transmission as those relays and the gunset drop out and the power is turned off allow the transmitter to transmit briefly on its stored voltage in the capacitors, the power supply capacitors. The relay moving means that the gunset is seeing different amounts of impedances and the transmitter is acting in funny ways, giving you a cyclic function, a guess on my part. Next guy who signed in was Steve. Haven't heard you for a little while, Steve. KC2, MDP, K2LAW. You got it, Steve.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. I've been kind of busy at work. I got a kind of a question that's puzzling me. Okay, I have it's an ICOM ring, it's a dual band rig, and the strange thing is it'll fold back in power, it'll cut back half power. Weird thing is let's say take 2 meters for example, is in the lower part of the band, 144, 145, I'll get full power out of the rig. Mid around 146, where we are now, it'll fold back to about 50% power, and then up around 147 or so, it'll slowly climb to full power. It'll basically, it'll be like 50-60%, and within a second or so, it'll climb to full power. I tried a dummy load on the rig. The rig puts out full power on the dummy load. And I did an SWR reading, and it's kind of high. It's a little lower on the lower part, but it's, the worst SWR is about 1.6. I was just curious, as far as SWR, I figured, if it's good on the lower part, it would get worse as we go up in frequency or vice versa. But it seems like it's dipping in the middle here. Any suggestions? The only thing I could figure maybe is that the cable, it is 9913, and I would say the stuff's about 10 years old, so you think it may be the cable? Back to you, Dick.
At a quick break, what kind of antenna, Steve?
It's a diamond dual band, one of them fiberglass radome collinear type jobs.
Almost all of our modern-day solid-state, no-tune rigs, and particularly 2-meter kinds, will have a protection circuit in the final stage looking at reverse power. Standing wave ratio means that you got less than ideal Dizwar of the antenna on some particular frequency. Some power comes back down. The rig detects that reverse power coming back. It knows that that could potentially put the final stage at risk, and it therefore cuts back power. So the fact that you've seen 1.6 Dizwar near the frequencies where it goes into half power, I'm reasonably sure that's what's doing it. And there's a zillion ways of correcting it. One of the things that you and I are both going to be amazed about, Steve, is that you'd like to believe a rig going into the self-protect mode happens at something like a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio or worse. The fact that it happens at 1.6 standing wave ratio, of course, is alarming. But some of the rigs are that sensitive, and they do it that way. Let me see what Hal's got to say on this one. K6DPZ, K2RIW on TechNet.
K2RIW on TechNet, K6DPZ. Okay, well, it does sound like it's folding back, and the pool is folding back because of standing wave. Add a length of coax to the existing length going into the radio and see if it folds back in power in a different area. And that will exactly tell you that it's a standing wave that's causing a foldback.
And this exact subject is one where Hal and I do have a fairly strong technical difference of opinion. Without a doubt, what Hal just suggested to you, by changing the length of the cable, might correct the condition. And now how do you put the interpretation on that? When you change the length of the cable, you're changing the phase angle of the reflected signal. And sometimes that protection circuit of the transmitter final stage is phase sensitive. And also, some antenna tuners will go into a searching mode, never find a solution. You add a random length of extra cable on the feed line, and the automatic antenna tuner becomes happy because of the new phase angle it likes to see. The disagreement that Hal and I have is that can you really lower the standing wave ratio by adding a same impedance length of cable? Hal thinks we can. I'm fairly sure we cannot. And in order to settle it, John, KC2WGB, is tooling up as we speak, buying test equipment where he's going to do a laboratory test to confirm or deny. And also, Lou, NY2H, has submitted a technical paper on the subject that we have more than one interpretation for. So, as you can tell, some interesting thoughts are going out on this particular subject, Steve. You've got a very timely one. KC2MDB, K2LAW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, I can understand the high SWR. You know, like I said, 144, 145, it puts out full power. 146, anywhere in the 146 area, it falls back to about 50%, which it's doing right now. And then the thing that puzzles me, though, is you go up to like 147 or so, and it'll slowly increase in power. You know, the power will come back if you hold the key down for a second or so. And there were, you know, this happened about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and there were a day or two that it was full power on, you know, around the 146 band. So I was wondering, you know, could it be the cable?
When it comes to the causes of standing wave ratio, there's almost as many causes, Steve, as our listeners. Can the cable do it? Yes. Can the cable do it selectively only at 148, 146 versus 144? I doubt it. But all kinds of things can happen to the antenna. And when it comes to correcting standing wave ratio, there's a zillion ways of doing it. And each has its advantages, disadvantages, cost, and whatever, and weatherproofing. Lots and lots of ways of doing it. And that slow climb of power that you see, I'm guessing that the standing wave ratio that you got at that frequency where you get the slow climb is right at the threshold where the circuit is trying to decide, am I going to go to self-protect or not? We're right on the threshold of doing that. And so it's not going into a hard protect, it's going into a soft protect, so to speak. There's also the slim possibility that as you apply power to the cable, the standing wave ratio of the cable is changing because of water. I haven't seen that on 2 meters, but I've seen it on 432. I've had a condition where water is in the connectors on the top of the tower. As I applied power and the water slowly boils away, the Vizwar changed, sometimes getting worse, sometimes getting better. So a little more investigation is going to be required here. You've measured the Vizwar, that's good. You know it's higher than it used to be on your diamond antenna, the dual band in the beginning. And the 9913, I believe the older version of that had air in the dielectric, which gives it very low loss, but also gives it the ability to suck up water. And let's see if Hal's got any further comments on that. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Hal. And we're going to go to Eric after that. Hal first.
Well, possibly some moisture could cause a problem, too. But I'd say the first thing to do, add it into cable, see if it changes the area of where you're having to protect. That would be the first simple thing to do. Eric, why don't you pick it up, K6DPZ?
All right, K2RWK2J, just a comment here. Most of your Japanese radios that I've experienced, like the Yaesus and the ICOMs, once you start to get a visual that fits about 1.2.5, 1.3:1, the protection circuits will start to pull back on the power. The more visual you get, the less output you're going to get. So they're pretty good about that as far as like your determination of the circuit trying to decide. I kind of don't go for that. I mean, it's a standard bridge the way they do it. It's pretty much an analog thing. It's not, compared. It says, you're over this point, start to pull back. But they operate pretty linearly, even though there's a log amp in a lot of them, and how they determine how much to pull the power back. But they start to pull back at about 1.3, and the higher you go, the less output you get. And by the way, I have swept quite a number of 2-meter antennas at this point. And they're not very broad. They don't get you a lot of bandwidth. You cut the antenna to 1.1, try and get it as best as you can. The SWR starts to go up as you get away from the frequency that the antenna is actually turning to. K2RW, K2J.
Okay. The one thing you didn't answer, Eric, and I can tell you were starting to go in that direction, is that Steve has seen the power slowly climb when he's on the high frequencies. Do you have an explanation as to why it slowly climbs? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
I've got a couple of thousand feet of 9918, and unless you put those connectors on really nicely and tape them up to the extent that you're actually using some putty to seal them, you do get water problems with them. And not necessarily water, you get water vapor. So, depends upon how much power you're running on 2 meters. You've not experienced it on 2 meters. I have, when you're running 50 watts or 40 watts. I've seen 9913 behave badly.
Now, when it comes to, sounds to me like your ICOM is in good shape, Steve, obvious by the fact that it always puts out full power into a dummy load. It wants to see 50 ohms. And your antenna, at some of those frequencies, is giving it something else, obvious by the 1.6 VISWAR. As far as the climbing is concerned, the scientist inside of Steve wants to know what's going on. Therefore, a hypothesis is that at the high frequency where the power climbs, the VISWAR is slowly getting better. The VISWAR is going into a changing state as you hit transmit at the high frequency. The way to confirm that would be to measure the VISWAR in the time domain, if you know what I mean, while the power is climbing. Unfortunately, that's going to be a little bit difficult. If you had a two-needle type VISWAR meter, you could easily watch the exact VISWAR at every power level. If you're using a bird watt meter and you measure forward and reverse power and go to the chart and figure out what the VISWAR is, well, as the power is climbing, the forward reading is changing, the reverse reading is changing, and unless you're really fast, seeing what the real calculated VISWAR is versus time is going to be a little bit difficult. But I think we've given you some clues. Eric and I are both pretty sure that 9913 under power is capable of changing its power, particularly as you as the vapor state of the water that might be in there and so on. So any method you've got to monitor the VISWAR, particularly monitor the reflected power as the power is climbing, I think it would give you a confirmation of this, my hypothesis here, Steve. You got an interesting one, and when you discover what it is, please come back and tell us. And when it comes to suggestions for how to correct the standing wave ratio to make it perfect, there's only 50 guys listening that will give you suggestions. Some of them have got different opinions. K6DPZ, K2, here we go, K6, KC2.
Repeater, timeout.
actually get it right. KC2MDP, KQLIW. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, wait for the beeps here. Very good. Yes, you gave me some great suggestions. Yeah, I'm going to have, that's exactly what I think I'll do. I have one of those dual needle SWR meters here. I'll hook that up and see what's going on here. My thought was maybe the cable. Like I said, that stuff's got to be 10 years old or better now. And someone told me that 9913 is pretty bad for getting water in it. Back to you.
Let me suggest that you try to experiment at the 1-watt level.
Yeah, at the 1-watt level, he's most likely not changing the state of the vapor in the 9913, and therefore the VizWire will stay steady, and the rig will put out continuous power. However, at the 1-watt level, his rig doesn't go into self-protect, and he won't see it climb. In order to duplicate the condition in the living animal, he's got to be at the high power level where the power does climb. Maybe I've misunderstood you on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, KQLIW.
If there's water in the cable, you're going to get a certain amount of VizWire from it. And at the 1-watt level, you're not going to get very much heating, so it should change.
Sounds good. So as Steve gathers all the information, at the 1-watt level, he gets a known amount of VizWire that doesn't change. And at the higher power level, it does change. The power climbs, and he's going to see the VizWire change most likely. One further thing I'm going to show you guys is that 9913, many of the versions of it, have got a lot of air in the center. In other words, the center conductor has a significant amount of air before the rest of the dielectric and the shield on the outside. What we all forget about is air is a power piston. By that I mean, you start off on a hot day where the sun is beating down on your cable and it's up to a nice high temperature and the air inside has expanded, and along comes some rain. The rain immediately cools off the cable. You got water on the outside of the cable. The air inside cooling off starts compressing, starts contracting, starts making a partial vacuum. It wants to suck air back in from the outside world. That air from the outside world has got water mixed in with it, and that's one of the mechanisms by which the cable can suck in water. As such, any of the guys who build microwave equipment, where you've got a box of your electronics on the back of the dish, on the top of the tower, you almost always have to put a small weep hole at the bottom with a piece of screening to make sure the bugs don't go in, so that the water has a way to get out. Because if you have an air volume in any kind of a enclosure outdoors where the temperature is going to cycle, you can't make it a hermetic seal. You can get a weather seal, but you can't get a hermetic seal. It's slowly going to breathe as the air gets hot and cold. And that's one of the facts of life we have to learn to live with. Let me drop. Okay, the next person who signed in was Wes. And Wes, if you got one of those brief questions now, and many of your questions are quite elaborate, and so if you got one of the brief ones now, go right ahead with it. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet. I got it wrong, sorry. N2XJN. K2LAW. I'll eventually get it right, Wes. You got it.
N2XGN. I have a series of questions after Paul, but one of them would be, does fluorescent light bulb produce X-ray? Does the tungsten light bulb produce radiation of any kind? The question just for later would be, what difference is between filament of X-ray tube and light bulb and radio tube? What are the thermal electrons? How X-ray tube works and the nuclear level? Can electromagnetic wave produce X-ray? Not in the region of X-ray, so we have electromagnetic wave in, let's say, microwave region. Back to you.
I'm going to try to be brief on this one. I might not succeed. An incandescent light bulb where you've got a tungsten filament running at, let me pick a number, 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. I think most of them are more like 2,000. The photo floods are a little bit higher. There is a Rolle-Jeans curve. There's a whole bunch of curves you can look up when it comes to how much power at what wavelength is coming out of a piece of wire that's being heated. And as it gets hotter, the wavelengths get shorter and shorter. And it gets more power output at all wavelengths. It's a very characteristic curve. say absolutely not, but you're only being 99% right, so to speak. You heat up a piece of filament, and it's putting out every single wavelength. Your body at 98 degrees Fahrenheit is putting out a significant amount of energy at many frequencies. And if I got a sensitive enough radio telescope, as I did build once, and I aim it at your body, I will see the radio energy coming off your body. So everything that's hot is giving off energy, but the frequencies at which it does it and where the peak in the curve is very dependent on the exact temperature. So for all practical purposes, no real X-rays out of a filament of an incandescent light bulb. In the case of a fluorescent tube, are you getting enough temperatures, a high enough temperature, that to really make X-rays requires either extremely high velocity electrons hitting a target? That's the way a usual X-ray tube works. Let me drop. Where you've got an ionized gas running at an extremely high temperature, the mercury vapor inside of a fluorescent light bulb does run at a pretty high temperature. Does put out ultraviolet energy, and that ultraviolet energy hitting the phosphor gets reconverted into optical energy that we see. So is it putting out X-rays? I'd say an extremely small amount, because it's not yet high enough in temperature. But those are my guesses on that one. Anyone else with further information on whether or not a fluorescent tube puts out X-rays, whether or not an incandescent light bulb puts out X-rays, if you got some information on this, give us a call. That is right now. T2LAW in the TechNet.
And
Tracy.
Hey, Tracy.
Eric, with some further information. Go ahead, Eric.
Now, one of the problems with generating X-rays is you need a voltage high enough, and the way fluorescent tubes are, they just don't even make soft X-rays, so there's a number of papers on that subject, whereas in the beginning they used leaded glass as an envelope to fear that, but as, you know, time went on, they discovered that it just doesn't make it.
BGB with a comment.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, I often wondered that myself about fluorescent tubes. So what I did was I took standard 40-watt fluorescents, and I taped enclosed film carriers on the tube, left it there for days, developed the film. There was no sign of X-rays. Whether that proves it or not, I don't know, but I couldn't detect them on the film.
In my opinion, that's a pretty good test, John. Not perfect, but a darn good test. And the word X-ray is a relative thing. There's soft X-rays and hard X-rays. As you get the voltage higher and higher, the energy in the X-rays, which is probably equivalent to shorter wavelengths, they become harder X-rays. In other words, more intense. In theory, you can make X-rays that are so hard, so intense, they'll penetrate metal, and you can make an X-ray of a piece of metal. I've done that. I built an antenna, I guess it was about 3 years ago, and a company was putting injection molded rubber around the antenna, and we worried about whether or not any of the elements inside of the rubber of the antenna were being changed. We were getting a Vizwa problem. When you're building an RFID antenna, RFID interrogating antenna, you're looking for a Vizwa of 1.05 to 1, and I'm not kidding. So what we call Vizwa, that's a delicate transmitter. We were using X-rays to X-ray the metal to find out if anything had moved. And so it can be done. And the machine that does it, boy, you've got to be careful with that machine. Any further comments on this one, Wes? And then we'll go into those other subjects later on. WS2N, K2LAW.
By the way, a dental X-ray machine usually runs at 125,000 volts.
Yeah, and it easily penetrates the enamel of your teeth. And it gets primarily stopped by things like amalgam fillings, the metal fillings. Although, I wonder, Eric, have you ever seen any slight penetration? Have you ever seen a slight transparency of the amalgam fillings in an X-ray? KE2EJ, K2LAW?
No, I can't say that I have. Trying to interpret a dental X-ray for the layman here is not exactly an easy task, and it's something that takes a dentist a long time to learn how to deal with. Although I will say that a lot of dentists now are using these sensors as opposed to film, which is way more sensitive than this. The metal halide, you know, the silver halide in the film, and they're actually beginning to get more detail and also learning how to reinterpret it. And in fact, they've been able to cut the amount of x-rays they use in more than half in terms of making the exposure. K2RIWK2K.
As I see it, Eric, the really modern dentists are no longer using film with x-ray. My dentist has a object he puts into your mouth, which has got a, I guess it's the equivalent of charge couple device or FET sensors. In other words, it's a solid-state sensing array that he puts in my mouth, and he turns on the x-ray machine, and on the screen essentially immediately appears the x-ray. So you don't have to wait to develop the film. And so solid-state circuitry to do that function requires a lot less x-rays. It's a lot more sensitive. It's a hell of a lot faster. And I'd like to believe that many dentists are going that way. Any final comments on this, Wes, on this exact subject? WS2N, K2RIW. Here we go. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
CMOS, the sensors are CMOS.
Very good, CMOS. And boy, are they sensitive and fast. Go ahead, Wes.
Well, later on, I would like to share quite a different opinion about this matter. Actually, the electromagnetic radiation produced by deceleration of charged particle when deflected by another charged particle, typically an electron, is creating kinetic energy that is manifested by photon, and that photon usually lies in the range of X-rays. So any exchange of energy should be responsible for a phenomenon of producing the photons, and mostly photons in X-ray area. Brink-Shalong effect is the one that is doing that. And then if you take the incandescent light bulb with two filament and you put the voltage into one, now you're gonna see the early version of the X-ray tube letting drop. What actually is happening is tungsten is the main primary material that is being used for the X-ray tubes. And once we link, based on what I said before, with the stream of electrons from heated filament, we were dealing with thermionic emission that is heat-induced flow of charge carriers from surface of over the potential energy of the barrier. We must all have a production of the photons, and then two filaments in the light bulb will create the medium that is pretty much friendly to creation of X-rays and to X-GM.
I can see how you've developed that particular opinion, Wes. I disagree with that. We'll get into that a little bit later. An incandescent light bulb, tungsten filament, the amount of X-rays it's capable of making, in my opinion, is extremely small.
Just said, the amount of X-ray that is capable of making. I'm not saying about the level of it. I'm saying about production of an X-ray.
Okay, if we want to be exact about this, any object above absolute zero is radiating all possible frequencies simultaneously. How much, though? The curve. If it's way down at the bottom of the curve because the object is not hot enough, then X-rays, which require a lot of energy to be generated and a lot of temperature or heat to be generated, the amount of X-rays are going to be so small that to speak about them could be academic. We'll get into that a little bit later. The next person who had a question was Paul, WS2N, and I've only hit your call letters three times in the last few minutes, Paul. Finally, you came up, and you've got a real question. It's about time. Our NASA expert, WS2N, K2RIW, you got a Paul.
A real good stick. Yeah, this has to do with a grounding question. We put up a diamond 300, a one of dual band 2 meter 440 antennas a couple of weeks ago, and what I wanted to do is just, you know, we just got up to see how it worked, you know. You just, it's not mine, it's a, but he wanted to get the thing up real quick. You know, let's see if the antenna works or whatever. And rather than making a thing and going out, you know, getting towers, drilling holes on the side of the house and everything to put it up, there was a sale on at Harbor Freight for a flagpole, one of these telescopic flagpoles. It goes up 20 feet. So we put the thing at the top of it. Ran it up telescopically all the way up to 20 feet, which is about the top of his house, you know, a big house. And it worked really good. We bumped it to the side. We did bump it to the side of the rafter on the, you know, on the garage, so it can't go anywhere about, you know, halfway up. But it goes into a piece of PVC on the ground, and we're wondering, you know, maybe we should ground this thing, you know, for lightning protection. Although I'm kind of leaning against it. You know, there's TV antennas up there, there's a cable. There's a satellite antenna up there. I mean, nothing else is grounded. I mean, it just, you know, kind of looks like it should. You know, it's a 2-inch diameter thing, a little bit bigger than a 2-inch on the bottom, going up. So, I don't know. What do you think? Should we ground it? It's pretty good. I mean, talk about putting it up. I mean, we had this thing up in an hour. Back to you, Dick.
If you want to be double darn sure, yes, you're going to be doing some lightning grounding. In your particular situation, Paul, 99% of the guys don't ground for lightning, and most of them get away with it. And there's minor. The word grounding for lightning is very relative. If you open up a polyphaser catalog and you buy every product they've got for lightning protection, you do everything that's in their book. They've got a beautiful $20 book. Maybe now it's $30. It'll tell you a lot of the things you might want to know about lightning. You go to polyphaser, you order the book, you read it, and you do everything there. Still, in the worst case lightning strike, you're going to get damage. You're never going to get perfect protection from lightning. So it's relative. Very similar to if I'm putting a lock on my house to keep out a burglar. Well, am I going to lock every single window, every single door? And if there was smoke coming out of your house and all the doors were locked, that fire department owns your house. They'll just bore a hole in the side of the wall and go in there and put out the fire. So it's very relative. Can you really keep somebody out of your house? No. Can you really keep all lightning off of your antenna and protect for all possible situations? Of course not. But it's relative. As you add more and more protection, you're going to get a warmer and warmer feeling, and you'll sleep better each night. So Hal has done quite a bit of study of things like lightning bugs and whatever, and disconnecting cables. Let's get his opinions on this one. K6DPZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K6DPZ. Okay, first of all, Dick, I wanted to mention I'm on between 8 and 9, not between 9 and 10. I got 7 minutes. Now, if he can throw back me the question one more time, I'll try and come up with a fast answer for him.
Yeah, on the subject of lightning for this antenna, this Diamond 300 that was put on the top of a telescoping mast, do you think they should put lightning protection on it? And if it was you, what lightning protection would you put, Hal? Go ahead.
Well, I remember right there, that's a shunt fed antenna, so if it goes to DC ground, basically I'd ground the mast, and that should give them lightning protection, because it's shunt fed. It's not a series fed antenna where lightning will come down the feed line. Just make sure you ground the mast to a good earth ground. Go ahead, Dick.
I know that some of the telescoping masts you and I can buy, Paul, are made out of fiberglass. Some of them are made out of metal. The one that you bought at Harbor Freight, if it was metallic and you ground it, I think you've done 90% of what you want to do. If it's fiberglass, life's a little bit more complicated. WS2N, what was that mast made out of? K2LAW?
Yeah, it's just an aluminum mast, so, yeah, no big deal. We'll throw a clamp around that, maybe put in a ground rod and grounding clamp to it. No problem. Yeah, it's aluminum. inexpensive. You know, I mean, you know, to buy this thing is, and set it up. I mean, it's for people that want to put a flagpole up and take it down in a real serious wind. But I mean, if you bump it halfway up, I mean, it ain't going nowhere. Practically.
You get real fast, Dick.
What was that again, Hal? And Hal, I recommend you back off on that mic. It is creating some distortion.
Okay, one last comment. Let him see if the antenna is a shunt fed antenna. By taking an ohm meter and going from the center of your coax connector to the outside connection of your coax connector on your cable and see if you read very low DC resistance. That will confirm it's a shunt-mounted type of antenna. That's my only comment. Go ahead, Dick.
Good suggestion, Hal. And boy, did you make an improvement in your audio. Wow. You were making square waves before, and now it's beautiful. Okay, so that ohmmeter is going to confirm the antenna does present a DC short. The bottom of your aluminum telescoping mast, if you want to be pretty sure, you put a lightning grounding rod. The EIA standard for a grounding rod is 8 feet long, 5/8 inch diameter, galvanized steel or copper, sunk in the ground, the clamp on the top of it below grade, and that piece of wire doing the grounding is a 6-gauge piece of wire. That's if you want to do everything right by EIA standards. And buying that grounding rod is not very expensive. Making yourself a device by which you can pound it on the ground without destroying it, and hopefully your ground is not too hard. Those are all minor details. Good luck with that, Paul, and let us know how it goes. John had a question. We haven't heard a question from John for some time. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net. Dick, if you remember the other day we were talking about a crystal test I was making, I did what you recommended. I use a resistor, and I have some new data, and I think it's a little more confusing than I had before. Let me let it drop, and I'll give you the data if you have a pencil.
Ready to write.
Okay. The output of the generator, which was fed to the oscilloscope, was showing approximately 1.3 volts. So that was the quiescent signal. Now, that was at roughly 1 megahertz. Now there's a crystal in parallel across the oscilloscope, and the generator has a 1K resistor in series with it going to the other side of the crystal. At a frequency of 0.999986, okay, that was our maximum excitation. Went up to almost 3 volts. Let me let it drop. The strange part is, when I lowered the frequency to 0.999947, it went to 0.8, which was below the quiescent signal. So therefore, it was trapping out the signal to ground. And that's what I found with this crystal. At two different points, although they're very close in frequency, their defined difference is just amazed me.
That's a very nice experiment. Thank goodness you've got a frequency counter with enough resolution digits, and you've got a signal generator with fine enough tuning to it. And if it was a synthesized signal generator where you're trying to move to the nearest hertz, not every one of them can do it. If I understand correctly, your signal generator, 1K resistor, going to a junction. At that junction is a 10 times scope probe and the crystal to ground. First of all, do I have the schematic diagram correct before I proceed on this, John? Go ahead.
Yes, you do, Dick. Only there is no 10 times probe. It made no difference with the 10 times probe or direct probe. It just changed the attenuator setting, but no difference in the waveform or the measurements.
Please, you have a fast comment before I get out of here.
Yeah, I was going to tell him about series and parallel mode, and he saw both of them, and the fact that they're so close is exactly a confirmation. K6DPZ, about to leave us. K2RIW, go ahead, Al.
I just want to say, I don't know if you wanted to check a crystal to see if it was working or not. A very easy way of checking a crystal: take a little clip lead, put it from one point of the crystal to the other, get a grid dip meter, couple it near a grid dip meter, you can turn a grid dip meter and you'll see it a very sharp dip if the crystal has activity and will oscillate. And you can check the crystal that way. You can also lock the grid dip frequency with the crystal that way. Gentlemen, I got it. I did pick it up. K6DPC cleared.
We heard all of that, Al, but you forgot about the distance and you were putting out square waves again of audio. Okay, good to know that. And yes, a grid dip meter is a very loose oscillator when it sees an extremely high Q circuit like a crystal. And many crystals will have a Q as high as 100,000. And you can buy a industrial-grade crystal at 1 megahertz that has a Q of 1 million. You're about to ask, what the hell is Q? And there's about five different definitions for Q. Our voltage rise at resonance within the crystal. Resistive value over the inductive value at a particular frequency. Delta, change in frequency divided into center frequency, 3 dB roll-off center frequency, and so on. There's five different definitions of Q. And the highest Q devices, the most clearly resonant devices that we can get a hold of these days, usually are a quartz crystal. And so when you look at the equivalent schematic diagram, let me drop. When you look at the equivalent schematic diagram of a crystal, a good common sense would lead you to believe, hey, it's an inductor and a series in series, an inductor and a capacitor in series. It's really a mechanical piezoelectric device. In other words, you put voltage on it, the crystal distorts itself in some way, bends a little bit, and correspondingly, when you bend the crystal, it generates voltage. That's what piezoelectric is. It's a transducer. You can make a loudspeaker and a microphone out of it. Well, when you use it as a resonator, it's doing both. The voltage you apply deflects it. The deflection has a certain mechanical resonance. In other words, it rings like a bell, but it rings at 1 megahertz, so to speak, and so you get some voltage back. And when you look at the full equivalent schematic diagram of a quartz crystal, it's got a series inductor, which is Henry's, many Henry's. It's got a series capacitor that's a small fraction of a picofarad, and across the whole thing, there is another capacitor. And when you look at what that can do, at A frequency, it'll have series resonance and it goes to a very low number of ohms. At a very, very slightly different frequency, it has parallel resonance where it almost becomes an open circuit. And with that very little bit of difference, when you went from 4986 to 4947, let's see, you were moving something like 40 hertz. What you confirmed is that particular crystal you got has high enough Q. Let me drop. It has high enough Q that with 40 hertz of change at around 1 megahertz, you went from the series mode to the parallel mode. One of the things I know you're going to be a little bit disappointed with, and that is in the series mode where you wanted it to act as a shunt to ground, it only pulls your 1.3 volts down to 0.8 volts, and you'd expect it to be a little bit lower than that. And there's a bunch of explanations for why. But I'm reasonably sure you saw the series mode and the parallel mode with 40 hertz of difference. And depending on how you hook up a crystal in an oscillating circuit, you can be using the series mode or the parallel mode intentionally by the schematic diagram, by the topography of your layout, and you can decide which one of those modes you want to use because one of them does your circuit better than the other. And the manufacturer of the crystal may tell you that, hey, you're going to get better performance in the series mode on this crystal, and you're going to get better performance in the parallel mode on this other crystal. That's my first guess as to what I think you're seeing there, John. Beautiful experiment. KC2WGB, K2LIW on the deck, man.
Great explanation, Dick, because I was wondering if its activity at resonance as one frequency in parallel, why wouldn't that same frequency be the correct point to get maximum bypass the ground when it was put in series? The fact that the two frequencies were